Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Hey, folks. Welcome back to the WOW, the Woody Overton Window for September 9th, 2024, episode number 26. Mike Agovino here with Woody Overton. Happy Monday, Woody.
Too, bro. Monday. First Monday night football tonight.
It is amazing how much football season matters to us, isn't it?
And it is. And I tell my wife every year, I said, we interrupt this marriage to bring you football and hunting season. And she gets it. So I equate every city or every time somebody tells me where they're from, what state or whatever, I equate it to their football teams and their hunting, how good their hunting is. So I spent this past weekend doing what we do every year this time, having a work day, you know, starting to get things in shape, food plots and stands and cameras and feeders and all that, you know, guy time stuff. People think about hunting as you just go hunting. That's not how it is. I mean, it's a year
that's
round.
That's how someone like me thinks about hunting. Yeah. Just take your gun go.
It's a year round endeavor and it takes a lot, but this is just what we do.
July and August are like, baseball's just too slow. It just takes too long, even with the changes they've made. Who wants to watch a 3-hour baseball game? I mean, it seems like we need a sport we need something for July and August. I mean, even with the Olympics in there, I was starving for sports. I was starving for the start of football.
The end of summer, that part it's my least favorite time of the year. And then it becomes my favorite time of the year, which is, you know, the fall and football and hunting and holidays and all the good stuff. So,
yeah, well, this is the latest in the season, in any season that Vanderbilt's been undefeated in about 50 years. So,
man, I lost on Vanderbilt the first weekend. And man, they were impressive, huh? The SEC. So,
well, see, that's what the whole transfer portal can do is you can be a shitty team, but if you end up scoring 3 or 4 key people through the portal. Now, the thing is, you'll never keep them the next year if you're Vanderbilt, right? So you'll come, maybe you'll have a decent year. Maybe you'll make some shitty third tier bowl game nobody's ever heard of, but then you're going to lose all these good guys you got in the portal because now they can go to maybe somewhere like LSU or Georgia or Alabama. And let's face it, make $1 million or, you know, some kind of meaningful chunk of change. They're never going to make in Nashville playing football at Vanderbilt and NIL has made college a money sport now.
And I always agree that the players should have get paid something besides, you know, scholarship and be starving in the dorms, or whatever, and food. But this whole transfer thing, it's just crazy. Everybody is from everywhere else. And, you know, like you said, if they have a good good year at Vanderbilt, and they're going to transfer to a bigger market. And they may not get to place as much in the bigger market, but they have a better opportunity at marketing themselves. So,
yeah, this kid that was from California, ukulele is his name. Sounds like a ukulele, but he's now playing in his third season for his third school. I mean, it's like you play for more colleges than you do pro teams in a career now. I mean, just absolutely crazy. Three colleges in 3 years. That's, I don't know.
Sign of the times, bros. And speaking of football, I saw the Nittany Lions had a big win the first weekend.
Yeah, they did. And they're supposed to have, I think they're ranked like sixth or something. But I guess it's all sort of about positioning for the playoff and the, you know, seeding in the final 12 now. And, you know, we'll see how the behavior of these teams that are sitting at the top of the pack, is affected, or if it's affected at the end of the season. But, you know, I thought, especially since with your travels, we had to skip a week. So it's 2 weeks since we've talked about this. I thought maybe a good place to start would be just to ask you, you know, we're about a third of the way into the trial here where we left off. What are your perceptions of the case at this point, if you had to just sort of bottom line it?
Couple thoughts on that. Yeah, one, I'm going to give you props for believing so strongly in what you believe in. No doubt about that. Then I've said that, and I'll say it a thousand times, that you have to respect that, whether you respect your position or not. I mean, you certainly believe what you believe. And I guess I'm as biased, and I hate to call you biased, but I'm as biased, probably somewhat unfairly on my way, because I did it and I lived it and work these cases and still continue to work this sex accusation cases and everything else. I don't know, my honest to God true thought is that I totally believe some of them are just totally full of shit and got on the bandwagon for the money, but I just don't know how it can all be false, you know. But I'm still waiting, and I know other people are. Certainly, if you've done nothing else, you've enlightened me to the fact that, you know, there were money grabbers in the situation, and I can't say who I think is one way or another yet. But I also think that the rub for a lot of people besides you, in a sense, Sandusky, the rub is probably, I don't want to call it victim shaming, but like talking about the moms and going out and partying and, you know, I think that rubs a lot of people the wrong way. And what I understand is it's part of your narrative and trying to paint the picture of what you're trying to do.
I think that's really fair. Look, I don't know if you would put a percentage on it, but I'm sure the vast majority of cases like this that you investigated in your career, the person was guilty.
Well, you know, I work more sex cases than anything else. All of the cases combined, not just in law enforcement, but on the defense side. And unfortunately, so many of them are false. And usually it's the kid is coming of age, a teenager, and the parents have split up, and it's the girl's time to go to daddy's house for the weekend, and she don't want to go because she has a boyfriend, and mama lets the boyfriend sleep over, daddy won't, and so she says, "Daddy touched me," you know, and then he's fucked. Regardless of whether or not it's true, you're fucked because you have to go through the process and everything else, and you can't take that back. And I've actually talked to one of them that was many, many years later that made the false accusation, and naturally didn't bring charges and all that. And she was like, she said, "You know what? I was just a shithead, and I didn't realize what it would do and what kind of shit." They don't think ahead. They don't know all the repercussions that are come back on the people that they accuse. And but I've worked so many of them that are true, and they're horrible and fucking, you know, just horrible.
Well, I think what made it so hard for me to believe this in the beginning, as I started to learn more about it and expose myself to it, is the raw numbers. Is you hear that, you know, there are 10 victims at trial. You'll learn that Penn State paid off over 30 claims. I think it was like 33 claims in the end that they paid off. And so you hear the sheer number and you just automatically think, well, come on, you can't, 33 people can't be lying. That's
right. But, and then you get into reading victim or alleged victim testimonies in court and hearing the things that they say that were done. And then they hear it from the next one and it was pretty much the same thing and it's done. And you know what? I always tell, well, on the defense side, I tell people, I'm like, man, you know, there may be some little rare, like the girl sent a nude photo or whatever, but they never had sex. I'm like, motherfucker, you better take a plea, because if you go before that jury and 12 regular people, like we've talked about this numerous times on the show, you go before a jury, 12 regular people who have kids and grandkids and daughters and nieces and nephews, whatever, they go to work every day, and a lot of them go to church on Sunday and stuff. Look, they're not used to hearing this kind of stuff, and they get pissed, and they want somebody to pay, and that's, you know, that is a very real deal. You sit up there and you hear these allegations, and you hear these victims or alleged victims state these things, and they're in a court of law, and ooh, somebody's going to fucking prison. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, I get it from the outside looking in, it seems impossible. And I'm not, and we never were, alleging a conspiracy here. If there's a conspiracy, if you want to call it, it's a conspiracy of self-interest, where there's this unique alignment of common interest between parties you would never expect to find an alignment between. You know, for instance, just at a gut level, you would think that Penn State would be heavily invested in defending their reputation, defending their school, defending their administrators, because it's the school's reputation that's on the line. Yet that ends up not being the case, because the board of trustees of the university made the decisions that really drove this whole thing and created the media panic that ensued. They decided, off of nothing more than having heard the attorney general deliver the presentment and a couple of days worth of reporting around that, they decided, with the conflicted governor of the state being the one overseeing it, they decided to fire the president of the university, Graham Spanier, and Joe Paterno, and Gary Schultz, and Tim Curley. And so at that point, the accused, if you will, the university, the institution, actually became deeply invested in their own guilt, because Penn State were actually innocent and there was no cover up and Sandusky never abused any kids. Oh my God, what a fuck up.
Right.
I mean, to have made those decisions without doing the proper amount of diligence, without doing a deep investigation, that and you have on any board of trustees in a big state university like that, you've got some of the biggest names in the state, some of the wealthiest people in the state, some of the most important CEOs in the state. And that's what you, in this case, you had two people in particular, the governor, Tom Corbett, who had been attorney general before he became governor and was the one who actually got the grand jury started on the Sandusky investigation. And it's amazing that this has never been the subject of an appeal for Sandusky, but he was in the ultimate conflicted position. He's sitting there as the senior person on the board of trustees who's telling the other board members to remember the boy in the shower as they decide that that they are going to fire the winningest coach in college football history and the president of the university. Yet he's the one who brought the case forward as attorney general. So he's in that conflicted position that gets this thing started. But most people at a distance would look at it and go, well, Penn State is certainly behaving as if they're guilty. They're doing all of these things. They're having the vigil on Friday night. They're doing the prayer at the 50-yard line. Scott Paterno is talking about victims on the front yard of his father's house. All indications are this story is true because Penn State is treating it as if it's true. So you have this alignment develop between the party that's actually guilty. I mean, yes, it's Jerry Sandusky and it's the administrators by connection to him, but it's actually the university itself, because it's the university itself that pays off all of these people who claim they were abused. And so the university is the one who stamped the story as true by terminating those people, and therefore they needed victims to pay off to prove that they weren't wrong when they made the terminations. And so you've got this alignment between the state government that's prosecuting this, the institution that's actually accused, the media that adopted this story and adopted the government's narrative immediately and turned this into the top story in the country for a year and a half and turned Sandusky into the most hated man in America. But they never did any diligence, just like Penn State never did any diligence. And so all of this has happened. And 6 months later, 7 months later, here's Sandusky on trial, and all of these accusers have lined up their own lawyers who are all, you know, from the personal injury space, because it's very clear to all that this is a payday for those that come forward. And so that's why it's so hard to get people to see that something like this could actually happen without it being an intended conspiracy or the intended consequence. I think Tom Corbett cared about one thing, that was getting Graham Spanier. He found a way to get Graham Spanier, but Paterno got sucked into it, even though they didn't intend to suck him in. And by sucking Paterno in, the Paterno family makes the decision to sever any ties with Sandusky, which is declaring Sandusky guilty. And all of a sudden, this thing has momentum. It has a current that nothing can stop. And on the other side, you have an accused man who's so naive, is just so living in Mayberry in the 1960s in his mind that he can't fathom that they're going to find him guilty. Don't they realize what he's done for this community? Don't they understand who he is as a person who he and Dottie are as individuals in the community, how many kids they've fostered, how many kids' lives they've helped through Second Mile. And so he makes a terminal decision and hires a local yokel to defend him. And his attorney, Joe Amendola, is so overmatched in this and everything that happens before this trial and during this trial that he probably helps the other side far more than he helps Sandusky. He's so unprepared and just so inexperienced at anything like this. He's been settling little cases in State College, Pennsylvania for 20 years, not litigating against the best litigators the state has to offer. And so on all sides, I mean, it's just this perfect storm of self-interest. And on Sandusky's side, I would just say naivete, somebody who didn't understand that the way they were living their life, how close they were getting to these kids, how involved in their lives he was inappropriate. You're not their father. Your hand shouldn't be on their knee. Your arm shouldn't be around their shoulder. You shouldn't be writing them letters challenging so directly their character and their commitment to school and their commitment to God and everything like that. But he, that's who he is. And for all of his life, and from 1979 when the Second Mile was started, for all those years, it served his interest very well. And he had such a positive impact on so many kids that in his mind, this formula of his worked.
Hey, everybody, it's Aggo. Listen up, especially you ladies over 40. I've got some good news. It's called Hormone Harmony. Hormone Harmony is an all-in-one hormonal balancing solution. It relieves symptoms of menopause. It promotes healthy weight loss and curbs cravings. It improves sleep quality. It reduces bloating and gas. It relieves hot flashes. It can even relieve occasional mood swings, although nothing like that has ever happened in my house. Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalance should take it, but it's perfect for the horrible menopause symptoms that make you put your life on hold. For a limited time, you can get 15% off on your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use code RLRC at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and code RLRC at checkout for 15% off today.
Do you want to set your child up for success? Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with a subject?
IXL now.
Is your child ahead,
real life,
not getting challenged enough in class?
Get an exclusive
IXL Learning is an online learning program that enriches your homeschool curriculum. It offers practice in math, English, language arts, science, and social studies while adopting to each child, meeting them where they are. Plus, IXL encourages students to be curious and empowers them how to choose to learn. Now, Cindy used IXL in the classroom as a teacher and now uses it to homeschool our youngest son in the ninth grade. The videos are what she finds that benefits him most in math because he's a very visual learner. The perfect supplement to your homeschool curriculum, IXL offers interactive practice problems, educational game lessons, and video tutorials for every topic you're teaching at home. It's easy to use, time-saving, and everything on IXL is organized by grade, subject, topic, and subtopic, making it simple to find activities for the exact skills you're covering. Instant grading, helpful progress reporting, IXL offers instant feedback and explanations of new topics as kids use the program. Flexible and personalized. Kids can explore any topic in any grade level. They aren't forced into a single learning path like they are on other programs. If you're homeschooling your child because they were falling behind or because they were too far ahead, IXL is a great program to help them get the exact support they need. It's fun for kids, and kids love IXL's positive feedback, awards, and educational games. And it's trustworthy. IXL is trusted by 15 million students worldwide and has proven to improve performance in over 75 scientific research studies. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And Real Life Real Crime listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/today. Visit IXL.com/today to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
This fathering of, mentoring of these kids. And if you look at what they did as parents, they lived that life. They fostered many kids over the years, only one of whom ever accused Sandusky of anything. And we'll probably talk about him next week, Matt Sandusky, which is a crazy story. But I get why it's so hard to believe. And I guess the thing I always come back to, and Ziegler always says, this is where he really turned the corner and started to see things differently, is he said to himself, which of these victims do I believe? Whose story do I buy? And when you take them one by one, not as a big roll-up of the 10 at trial or the 33 that get paid, when you take them one at a time, it's really, really difficult to believe any of them, except probably number 6, Zach Constance, who is the only one who tells basically the same story the entire time. And he's the 1998 kid who tells the jury that Sandusky never abused him and never touched him. There was the incident in the shower, which he came to understand later as grooming, because he came to understand later that there were all of these other victims. So it must have been grooming. There was no other lens for him to see it through, right? So does that make sense from my side? It's unique, right? Have you ever seen anything like this case?
The one thing is I can relate to is the Catholic Church scandal. And I know there were people that were full of shit, but I also know it's an acute political emergency. It comes down, yes, in the beginning, should they done Paterno and all of them? No, but that's just the way shit rolls. And they, you know, you're talking about hundreds of victims per priest. And then you have the organization that moved them from parish to parish. Every time they would get a complaint, and they'd ship them somewhere else. It's before the internet and all that. And they'd ship them somewhere else and hush it up. When it finally, breaks and people start getting paid, then they come out of the woodworks everything's been prescribed. And it's just to stop it from going to this level, from going to trial. And I'm not saying, I certainly believe a lot of them were abused. That's the only thing that you can, in the history of the world, I think that you can compare it to, that has this kind of media coverage and political involvement.
Right. And I think it's really, really relevant, because while most of the alleged abuse happened before the Catholic Church scandal surfaced, the actual trial and this becoming public and everything happens after.
Yeah.
And so
let me say one more too. Then other stuff comes out, like the Boy Scouts and these different organizations, whether it be Catholic or whatever. It's certainly not just Catholic priests that offend it. But then you have, I think, more people started speaking up, and then certainly more people would come forward hoping for a payday, that whatever. But yeah, I think it really became more of the thing to do, this whole woke movement or whatever they call it now. So yeah, it's kind of a sign of the times, but you know, you're always going to have somebody that's full of shit. And, but these things get started. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
So I think it's a snowball effect and it's shit's going to roll.
I think in a different environment, the McQueary story and the way that it plays out at trial would be seen as just comedy, like Abbott and Costello level physical comedy, because they are trying so hard to make a bullshit story become real for jurors, that, you know, they do this thing with the mannequins, which, you know, now they're and they realize that the mannequins are actually sort of proving that the logistics don't work because of the differential in the size of Sandusky versus the kid. And so they just decide to put a footstool into the pictures with the mannequin, so that the mannequin portraying victim number two would be tall enough for the sexual act to have been possible. Then there's the witnesses that they have to use to support McQueary's latest version of the story that he sells, that he tells on the stand. And there's this bizarre situation with his father, John McQueary, who had just testified months earlier in a preliminary hearing for Schultz and Curley's trial. And they are trying to impeach him with his testimony from this preliminary hearing from several months earlier. And so they're literally reading from a transcript what he says at the preliminary hearing. And he says, "I wasn't there." Well, wait a minute. We have a transcript from the Commonwealth, from this court on this date for this preliminary hearing. Here's your transcript. Here's your answer to these questions. I wasn't there. And then they appeal to the judge, and the judge says, "You heard him. He says he wasn't there." I mean, it's just absurd.
These are the kind of things that the appeals process is made for, because shit like this is stupid. And if you go look up at Justa, J-U-S-T-A, and then you can type in anybody's name, like any of my cases, say, because I know the bad guy's name, you type it in, and they'll, when they file their appeals, they'll say maybe it's 38 counts of violations that were done, and that's why my client should be free or get any trial or whatever. And certainly this should have been brought up in appeal. Why wouldn't you let a matter of public record be used to impeach this witness? Because if he's impeached, then if he lied then or he's lying now, and he's not credible. So that should have been something that's brought up on appeal.
Well, in this particular set of charges, the jury finds him not guilty. And so there's not, the jury finds McQueary not credible. His father's lack of testimony, the mannequins, the combination of everything, all the changes in his story, the jury, the lack of an actual witness, an actual victim, because remember, Alan Myers is not there at the trial, victim number two. And so they don't have the person there. They have this crazy testimony with the mannequins. They have all the versions of McQueary's story. They have his father denying he gave a testimony that he gave. But somehow, because if you think about it, that is case. That is the victim that launched the entire media panic. That's the story that was the headline story in the presentment that was told by the attorney general that got every news crew on planet Earth to State College, Pennsylvania, was that this grad assistant had witnessed Sandusky performing anal sex on about a 10-year-old boy in the Penn State showers. Yet at trial, the jury says that didn't happen. But everything that formed perceptually around this case in that area formed because this story was accepted. And yet there's no sort of squaring that with anything else. Because I think if you could reverse the impact of all of that media, of all of that attention surrounding that, and then you looked at the case of Aaron Fisher, victim number one, and looked at number one, his character, and what did his school think about him? What did the people that knew him think about him and say about him? What did we find out about his mother, her history? What happened to her brother? What happened to her second husband, who I believe is still sitting in a Georgia prison, guilty of over 100 counts of child sexual abuse? And so when you look at Aaron Fisher and you look deeply at it, I don't believe if he was a one-off that, and the proof is sort of there. It took two grand juries, it took 3 years, and it took his third testimony before the grand jury moved forward, and they didn't move forward exclusively with his story. It wasn't until they got the McQuarrie, which we know isn't true, and they got the 1998 that was supposed to have been expunged. It's those three things are the pillars of this case, and yet we know one is a fabrication, is a lie. Fisher, I think as we move forward, we will see that he was abused, but far more likely he was abused by his stepfather, who's in a Georgia prison, who pled guilty to abusing over 100 kids. And so, again, it's a numbers game, because as you move through the trial, you have, you know, victim number three, Jason Simcisco, who testifies. And again, it's another instance where the story changes dramatically over time. And, you know, we come to find out with Simcisco that he and Jerry lost contact with each other because he moved to a different foster family. And that foster family refused to deliver letters from Sandusky to Jason. So he thought that Jerry had abandoned him. And that was the source of his anger at Jerry. And, you know, the two additional victims, well, I guess we should go to number five for a second, because number five is a fascinating story. This Michael Kajak is victim number five. And he came forward first saying that that Sandusky had made him touch his penis in the Penn State showers in 1998, but that he didn't say anything to anybody and he didn't do anything because he was only 10 years old at the time and didn't know what an erection was. But they needed a victim to have been abused by Sandusky after the date of the McQuarrie incident in order to prove that Penn State's negligence, Penn State's cover-up, caused more people to be hurt. And so he changes his story from it happening in 1998 to it happening in 2001. And then during his testimony at trial, he actually gets confused and uses both 2001 and 2002 as as dates. And if you think back to what he said, which was that he didn't say anything and didn't think anything because he didn't know what an erection was. Well, maybe that makes sense if you're a 10-year-old in 1998, but it doesn't make a whole lot of sense if you're a 13-year-old in 2001 or a 14-year-old in 2002, like you say you were at trial. Over the course of time, I guess these guys never think that the settlement documents are going to become public. And so they've told so many different versions of their stories that they don't think there's going to ever be any triangulation and discrepancies are ever going to be pointed out. And so Kajak's story in his settlement documents is completely different than the story that he tells at trial. And the specific differences in his story are the kind of differences that lead to Penn State offering a larger settlement, right? And so we've been through the victim 8 story, where this is the custodian who comes forward saying that in 2000, another guy named Calhoun, who was with him, witnessed Sandusky having oral sex with a teen in a Penn State locker room. And this is a great example of the incompetence of Joe Amendola. Joe Amendola had been delivered boxes and boxes and boxes of discovery information just 3 weeks before the trial. But in there was a taped interview between police and Calhoun before Calhoun's dementia set in, where Calhoun states clearly 3 different times that it was not Sandusky who he saw in the showers. The prosecution gets Judge Cleland to allow this custodian, Ron Petrosky, as a hearsay witness under some excited utterance rule, where he's allowed to testify as to what Calhoun saw, even though the state already knew they had testimony from Calhoun saying what he saw was not Sandusky 3 times. So they say that that Petrosky is going to testify, and then a second hearsay witness is going to testify. Well, they never produce that second witness. No one else ever takes the stand. Calhoun's taped interview is never presented by Amendola in defense, and Sandusky is found guilty of 5 counts on this crazy story involving double hearsay, if you will, of janitors. Yeah. I mean, it's just crazy.
If you take all of these, like the judge earlier not allowing, even though they didn't get found guilty, not allowing the preliminary hearing transcripts in, and all the way down to this the hearsay stuff and all that. I mean, that's, again, if it was just a State versus Sandusky, I'd have every one of these listed in a bullet point in the appeals. And that doesn't take back the fact that he got convicted on those 5 counts. But I mean, that's what you have higher courts for, right? And whoever's the governor, whatever, it doesn't matter. You can take it all the way to the Supreme Court, where these people don't have influence or any type of influence over those justices. I mean, certainly you make a compelling case in, you know, Amendola going up against those prosecutors. Certainly, those prosecutors, these are the only cases that they do. The Attorney General's office, they work sex cases, kids' sex cases. And so they did every day of their career. They prosecute these cases over and over again. And it'd be like me fighting Ryan Loader. I'm Amendola and Ryan Loader, and I'm going to kick your ass. And then it's just totally, like you said, mismatch. But I don't understand is why he hasn't on these things. They haven't been overturned on appeal. And one more thing, too. Frank Fina lost his legal license because his actions in this case. What was it specifically that he lost them for?
Believe it or not, it was a series of sharing pornographic material across.
Oh, that's right.
State.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. See, in the state of Louisiana, when you work in these cases and the AG's office has it, even if you're a detective in whatever jurisdiction, you can't get that. You can't get the material. You have to be set an appointment time. Even the defense can't get it. They have to set an appointment time to go into the AG's office and review the materials on the screen. Because it's illegal. So I guess he got it and he shared it or something. Fuck, he should have gone to prison for that.
Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.
So between November and the trial in June, there are two additional victims that the state adds. So there's at trial, there's 10, while back in November, there were 8. Number 9 is a guy by the name of Sebastian Payden. His story is just unbelievable. So this is during the time period where they're receiving all kinds of inbound about people saying they were victims of Sandusky. And so Payden is chosen along with this guy, Ryan Rittenmeyer, from amongst who knows how many people that had supposedly come forward. But his story is that he became a prisoner of Sandusky in Sandusky's basement, and that Sandusky's basement was a soundproof room. And so no one in the house, and remember, Sandusky always had a very full house because he had all of these between his adopted and the kids they were fostering. It was always a full house. And Payden's story, time frame wise, overlaps with Aaron Fisher's story, which was also that Jerry was abusing him in that basement. Now, everybody gets a picture in their mind about a basement when you say basement. And I think most people would typically think that was, you know, a full level down, a 10, 12 steps down to a very separate and secluded, area separate from the rest of the house. The construction of the house, the basement was, I'd say somewhere between a sunken living room and an actual basement. It was 6 or 8 steps down to it. And you could actually, at conversation level voice, you could carry a conversation on with somebody in the kitchen. There was no soundproofing whatsoever of that basement. And so to accept Payden's story at all, you have to believe that not only Dottie Sandusky, but everyone who was in that house at that time, over that period, was in on it, was covering for Jerry's abuses, because this guy contends a massive amount of abuse, over 100 instances of being abused. And he talks about bleeding. He talks about the pain and screaming, begging for help, being denied food, all of this stuff that just doesn't make a whole lot of sense when you consider the logistics of the rest of the home to that quote unquote basement, and the fact that there was no soundproofing. Also, I mean, that's a situation where perhaps if there was going to be physical evidence in any one of these cases, that's one where you might expect that there would be some physical evidence, right? If you're constantly bleeding over time. I mean, if there's any accusation that shoulda, coulda had physical evidence, it's logical that it would have been that one, but it never was. This guy ends up getting the single largest settlement of any of the victims. Penn State pays him $20 million for his story. After he gets the money, he posts a picture on Facebook of him with money all over his body, laying on a bed, saying, quote, "Shit, man, I'm bawling like a motherfucker. Money. I don't know. I've never been in that situation, but I can't believe, as a survivor of that kind of abuse that he alleges, that you'd be capable of posting something like that." He also is, you know, he attended a Penn State game with Sandusky in September of 2011. I mean, 2 months before Sandusky is charged, this guy who accuses him of brutally raping him, denying him food, holding him as a slave in a soundproof basement, is going to a football game with him? Yeah. I don't know. That's a tough one. And yet, $20 million. The irony, by the way, of victim 10, this Ryan Rittmeyer, is that there's no evidence, and it's actually comical. This kind of speaks to what a goofball Sandusky is, because during a phone call with Ziegler, Dottie, and Jerry together from prison, Ziegler asks if they knew victim 10, and Dottie says no. And Jerry says, yes. And then Ziegler says to Jerry, you did know victim 10? And Jerry says, yeah, I met him at the trial. Mm. I mean, that should give you a feel toward just what we're dealing with in Sandusky here. And so this, and this guy accuses Sandusky of abusing him in a silver convertible. Sandusky never had a silver convertible. Sandusky never rented a silver convertible. There's no evidence that they ever met. They didn't meet, according to Sandusky, until the trial. And his story is so far afield from any other story that we've heard in this case. And it's about a car that Sandusky's never owned nor ever rented, as far as anybody can tell. And so this is who these victims were as witnesses. And you go through them. And again, if you separate that there's this big pile and that there's all of this mass media attention around this case because of the stories surrounding a victim, the jury itself determined wasn't a case that wasn't true. I go back to what I said before. The most credible story that is told is the story told by number six, Zach Constance, which is a story about grooming that is believable because you could easily see how Zach came to believe that because of all the other victims that came forward, right? But every other story from Brett Holtz, number four, who had said he was never touched, and then we have the tape of the his lawyer Andreozzi and the police officers conspiring when they think they're not being recorded to feed him false information in order to get him to feel comfortable about claiming he was a victim, and then he becomes the star witness, the first one at the trial, who was already well lawyered up and lathered and set up with the same therapist. And again, while there's a lot of literature out there that endorses a repressed memory theory, and there's a lot of material out there that goes against the idea of repressed memory therapy, there's never been a case where almost all of the victims use recovered memory as the rationale for why their stories that they're telling at trial are so different than what they told police when they were first interviewed. And again, there's not a single one of the original eight that told police when they were interviewed that Sandusky had ever touched them. And the incidents that launched this whole thing were not brought forward by the victims. They were brought forward by the mothers of the victims. And so, you know, when you look at this and you start piling up the 10, not looking at it as a sum of its parts, but looking at it as parts, I just again go, all right, which of these 10 do you believe? And, you know, do you believe any of the ones that would indicate Sandusky is guilty? Sandusky is the kind of monster who could have committed these abuses. And again, other than victim six, I don't know where it is.
I think in reading the trial transcripts, you know, I think it's not so much what they found them on. It's not so much these inconsistencies in stories, the convertible, the basement, and again, back to the basement thing. I told you about going to Wisconsin, and to me, it's like it's soundproof, but I can still hear what's going on upstairs, right? I can hear them talking and stuff like that. But the one thing that sticks out to me in reading all the victims' testimonies is the one thing that was pretty consistent, and I know what you're going to say, is that they were coached on it. One thing that's pretty consistent is the cycle of the abuse, the things that he did, that they said he did. Started out with the tickling and the horseplay and then blowing raspberries on the belly and this and this. That's one thing that the ones that testified were there, actually there testified that they said. And I think that obviously the people sitting on the jury disregard the rest of it as could have been too long you know, too long a period of time, they can get dates messed up, But look, they said this, this, and this, and this consistently.
Yeah, and I think, and
that's,
Zig,
that's the hard shit to hear, the shit that they actually said, and then it progressed to this, and this, and then, even though, you know, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but even though that they said it wasn't verbatim, each one of them, but there was the same general context of the bad shit. And then when you hear the bad shit, that's what you focus on, because you're that regular Joe on the jury, you know?
Right. Well, look, I think that for the vast majority of them, you know, not like number nine and number 10 and number eight, but the core kids who Sandusky believed he was a father figure to, that his relationship with them was for, you know, whether it was 1998 or 2004, whatever, for the times, was inappropriate. It might have been behavior recognized as appropriate from a father figure, an uncle, your dad's best friend from down the road, whatever, in the 1970s or 1980s. But it, by the standards of the time, it wasn't appropriate. And if I found out that there was a coach that my son was, that coach was blowing raspberries on my son's belly, was cracking his back, was taking showers, with him, I would be concerned, and I would want to first try and understand it, and I'd want to stop it no matter what, but I'd want to understand if it was part of something broader and far more nefarious. And in the case of Sandusky, just my opinion, as I look at his life and understand where he came from and how he lived it, I think that he was such a naive throwback that he grew up in this rec home where his father had built it for the town, where he was one of a large group that was there every day, that took the group showers together, that he saw how his father built, it's called Brownson House in Washington, Pennsylvania, where he grew up. He saw how his father became such a hero to the kids of that town for what he built, that he wanted to emulate that in Second Mile. And he didn't realize just how out of touch he was. And the truth is, I think that those tactics, while inappropriate for the times, are often, if they're benign, are often very effective in getting a kid who's been shown no love, has no presence of a father in their house, who has been enabled to join this charity that allows them to play sports and go to camps. And there's this charismatic leader that takes a real interest in improving their life. To me, that's the far more believable scenario than Sandusky the monster, is Sandusky the completely out of touch, naive throwback who so desperately wants to help kids that he's consistently crossing a line that he thinks he can cross because he's Jerry Sandusky, he's everybody's dad, and he knows that, you know, confidence is going to come from these kids believing that someone believes in them and they're loved and everything like that. And I think that's the actual tragedy of this story, is that we had outgrown as a country, because it was too dangerous to have that kind of a father figure out there in the wild. It just, they're in 99 times out of 100, you know, a case like this, the guy might be the monster and the abuser. I just don't see anything in Sandusky's background or his behavior during or after, you know, now we're 12 years later in prison. You know how child abusers are treated in prison.
Yep.
Sandusky is loved and respected in prison because they all know he didn't do it. It's a crazy, crazy case that shows this, that what a false narrative from the media can launch, how that narrative can become fact in everybody's minds, how seemingly disparate constituents that would never be aligned all of a sudden can become aligned out of self-interest, Penn State, a board of trustees, and the state. And then, as we'll see going forward, how they'll even hire an investigator to come in and investigate them to find out and tell the investigator what the investigator needs to find out to exonerate them, which I'm referring to the Free Report there. But anyway, that's, you know, there are some character witnesses that are presented on Jerry's behalf, but the last two witnesses that we'll get to next week that I think are important to talk about relative to the trial are Matt Sandusky, who became at age 18 the adopted child of Jerry Sandusky. He wasn't adopted until age 18. We'll tell that whole story. And he doesn't become a quote unquote victim until the middle of the trial. So he is a staunch supporter of Jerry Sandusky's until like halftime at the trial when he comes out as being abused. And we'll talk about Dottie Sandusky, who takes the stand in what can only be described as an epic failure. Was in a position where she could have probably created some doubt here and was, for reasons we'll get into, not capable.
Yeah. Well, two things. When we get done, we won't be done because I'll make it short and concise. I'm going to show you, or I'll read the things that I found that, you know, pretty consistent. They were saying, and probably why, you know, sure, it's why the jury convicted him. But then I wanted to do one after that. I want us to do one after that on the appeals process and where it's been, what the status is, and all that. Cause I think that would be interesting to see. It'll put it all together on the back end, right? Cause that's ultimately the safeguard for it. And you've certainly made a case, one of the things that you pointed out. Like I said, that one of those items needs to be addressed on appeal, that including the soundproof basement and whatever, right? The convertible and what have you. But so we'll certainly not leave the people hanging, right? We got to tell a story. We got to tell where it's at now.
Oh yeah, I'm not. This is not an attempt to wrap things up. We have.
Yeah. I know we got a lot more to cover. I'm just saying I want them to know that we're going to put it. It's a long story. It's a lot of information, but to tell a story correctly, you got to be able to do X, Y, or A through Z, if you will.
And, for sure.
But if I'm a listener and I'm sitting here listening and I'm thinking, what the fuck's happening now? If all this is, this sounds so egregious, why isn't he beat it on appeal? But let's do an appeal episode because I think that would be
better. We'll do so. And you know what judge hears the appeals, right?
It can't be. It may be first level if they send something back down to be reviewed or whatever, but that's why they have judges above them in the appeals courts, and that's why they have a court above that all the way up to the Supreme Court.
Wait until you hear the story.
Right. Can't wait. All right.
Thanks, buddy.
All right.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. Appreciate it.
Love y'all, and get you some Monday night.
Absolutely.
And we will see you next time. right? Peace.
Haglets.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
While the world whizzes by, enjoy a moment of me time with Tim Horton's $6 breakfast bundle. Savor a small hot or iced coffee, then add your choice of a mouth-watering hot breakfast sandwich. Mm. And a crispy golden hash brown.
Ooh.
And your pick of a classic donut.
Yeah.
All for $6. All just for you. Make your mornings all about me time with our $6 breakfast bundle. Available at your neighborhood Tim Hortons. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.